The Lifeboat Hour with Michael Rupert, Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Nightclub at the end of the world with good atmosphere, good programming, good guests, and some good tunes. This is Mike Rupert. It is January the 15th, Sunday, 2012. And there's some good news in the air tonight. There's a few reasons to celebrate. I'm going to talk about those real briefly before we introduce a guest who I've been actually very excited to have on board for tonight's show for ever since he said yes. But there's been some major developments with regard to World War III and the looming and imminent attack on Iran. Basically, what has happened throughout the last week or 10 days is that the U.S.'s moves to shut off the Iranian Central Bank have hurt Iran seriously. There's been more bloodshed. But the U.S. oil embargo, the U.S. Western oil embargo shut off of Iranian exports has proved to be an absolute flop disaster, stillborn dead, really dumb idea, as I said it would be back in 2002 and 2003. And I have people like Colin Campbell and Matthew Simmons to thank for making it very clear. He said, they can't attack Iran because nobody can replace Iranian oil. And that was a long time ago. So we're seeing all that borne out. But in addition, Russia has stepped up to the plate mightily in several ways. It sent a ship full of arms to Syria, which arrived this week. It has announced that an attack on Iran would be viewed as a threat to Russia's strategic interests. In other words, you attack Iran, you're fighting us. The Chinese have made that clear also. The U.S. is basically in a fallback position around the world, but I'm very happy to tell you guys tonight that joint U.S.-Israeli missile exercises have been postponed. In other words, they've been called off. But in addition to that, Zero Hedge tonight is reporting that the United States, I think it's based on a story from Israeli radio, has said there will be no no-fly zone imposed over Syria. And Syria would have been the start, the joining of the battle for Iran. We're going to have a great time talking about all that stuff tonight with our guests. Let me just get a couple other things out because they're kind of important good news. Economically, everything is a total disaster, and we may not have mitigating headlines to distract our attention. Greece debt talks have broken down completely, and Greece is on brink of disorderly default, which will implode the whole global economy. But even if that weren't there, everything is just slowing down and stopping, if not due to energy shortages, due to a lot of other things we can talk about, again, with our guest tonight, but that's still out there. So let me give you some good news before I go to our guest. Many of us throughout this movement around the world, and not just the lifeboat movement or the transition movement, but we have been all uniformly opposed to fracking. And as we've been documenting on the World News Desk at CollapseNet over the last several months, fracking has been taking some serious body blows lately, and that's good, and that's wonderful. We can cheer for that, but we will have a story on the World News Desk tomorrow. It says, unlocking the secrets behind hydraulic fracturing. Quote, starting February 1st, drilling operators in Texas will have to report many of the chemicals used in the process known as hydraulic fracturing. Environmentalists and landowners are looking forward to learning what acids, hydroxides, and other materials have gone into a given well. But this is great. A less publicized part of the new regulation is what some experts are most interested in, the mandatory disclosure of the amount of water needed to frack each well. Yes. Experts call this an invaluable tool as they evaluate how fracking affects water supplies in the drought-prone state. Go for it. Fracking is not dead, but it's going down, and there's a couple of signs of sanity out there. So, now, how do I set up for this guest? One of the things that has been so gratifying for me over the course of the last year, especially since my involvement, deep involvement with Occupy, which is still out there kicking some ass. Occupiers occupied the roof of a Wells Fargo bank in San Francisco today, and they're holding tight in Washington, D.C., and all my brothers and sisters out there, I know, we know, that come spring, Occupy is going to be back. So anyway, I got that out of the way. But I've been shown a lot of respect in the last year for the life that I have led. And I've been shown respect by warriors and brave men and people who have kind of been heroes and inspired me. And that respect makes an enormous amount of difference. You can't measure it with ones and zeros, but it changes how you feel and the world you move in. And my guest tonight is somebody who, if you were to ask me, he's probably the guy that I respect most for telling the most truth for the longest, most accurately, most fearlessly, in spite of suffering all the, quote, slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. We go back to the late 1990s. I think we met in 99. But Michel Chelsudowski, here's what Wikipedia says. He graduated from the University of Manchester, England, and obtained a Ph.D. at the University of North Carolina. He is professor of economics emeritus at University of Ottawa. Chelsudowski has also been a visiting professor in countries throughout Western Europe, Southeast Asia, and Latin America. Also, he has been involved with consulting several different international organizations and has been an advisor to governments of developing countries. He's the founder, editor, and director of the Center for Research on Globalization. You can find that website at globalresearch.ca, http://globalresearch.ca. You'll see their stories frequently on our world news desk at CollapseNet. We have one from Michel going up tomorrow. He'll tell us about that. He's authored a great many books, but I got to tell you, this guy has been out there from the day Bush Cheney stole the election 2000. He's been out there screaming crooks, murderers, liars, thieves, and bullshit as loud as anybody else I've known. And I have utmost respect for our guest tonight, Michel Chelsudowski. Are you with us?
It's such a great pleasure to hear you. We haven't seen each other for several years, but I certainly recall our first meeting. That was back in 99. It was right in the midst of the war in Yugoslavia, and that in effect that was the onslaught of the responsibility to protect doctrine of NATO, because NATO bombed the hell out of Yugoslavia, and then you had the Kosovo Liberation Army, and I guess we were exchanging views on that.
We met Ramsey Clark that day, I think.
That's right. That was in L.A. There was a whole group of people. Ramsey Clark was there, Richard Beck, many others, it was a very inspiring moment, I managed in a short period of time afterwards to go around Los Angeles.
How nervous you were to be in the States even then.
I felt very much at ease, but I think I had ultimately had a plane to catch or something. Those were very good. That was pre 9/11, and then of course we met up again a few years later at the G7 Counter Summit in Calgary, Alberta, as you recall. And
yes.
That's
where I was kicked out of the country.
Yeah, well,
I was. They stamped an expiration date on my visa to Canada.
Yeah,
I had to leave the day before G8 started.
That's right. Well, but in any event, you had more people at your talk at the University of Calgary than they had at the G8. I think were 800 or 900 people. It was a tremendous event. And, of course, that is the history of this New World Order.
Mm-hmm.
It started in the 90s in the post-Cold War era. It's been a continuum of NATO enlargement. Yugoslavia, I think, was a very important watershed in how those events unfolded. And then, of course, 9/11 and 9/11 truth was what we were struggling for. And then we realized how all this has coalesced in what I describe as the globalization of war. Not to mention, of course, the instatement of more or less a police state in the United States of America with the repeal of habeas corpus,
mm-hmm.
signed into law by President Obama on December 31st in one small article of a 600-page document, the National Defense Authorization Act. I actually went through that document, and there's only one small section there, it's an ambiguous section, and it was misunderstood by many people. But it's there, you know, it's there. You can arrest U.S. citizens at will. As long as they are suspected terrorists, but that's only an interpretation for the law enforcement officers, and it's the militarization of law enforcement, it's the repeal of the Posse Comitatus
mm-hmm.
Act,
mm-hmm.
And it's the end of any semblance of constitutional government in the USA.
I don't think that the government's going to have full, willing, and complete compliance from either the military or the police department if they try to use those. I have no doubt that they believe they intend to. I want to get to some of the most important stuff that's most pressing right now. But
Mike, that's a very important point, because war and the police state emanate from civilians. They don't necessarily emanate from the ranks of the armed forces or the police.
That's correct.
Okay? And I think we might see some of that unfolding, because there are people within the ranks of the police and armed forces which are dead against what the civilian government is actually enforcing.
Tell me this now. Are you getting more respect lately? Because you sure deserve it.
Well, we're getting... I've never had any problems. Nobody has smeared me so far. My university has supported me in very difficult moments. I think what we get is tacit censorship and camouflage, mm-hmm. where the material that we will publish, everybody will do their utmost to more or less black it out.
Yes.
I'm talking about the mainstream media, but also academia. I used to write for the mainstream media. I was also frequently on radio and TV shows. And actually, it all ended in 1999. The moment I took a position against that war in Yugoslavia, I was considered to be out. I was a black sheep. Mm-hmm. I was no longer with the, you know, because the whole so-called progressive
invisible.
Left. They supported that war, and they said, yes, it's ethnic rights of... It's pretty much the same reasoning as Libya. No, they simply said, no, we have to... Milosevic is the problem. We have to bomb the country, come to the rescue of the Kosovo Albanians, and the KLA is a bona fide. I mean...
And the KLA is... Let me just add that Michelle and I have both done work on the KLA.
Well, that's
Kosovo Liberation Army, which was involved with the CIA drug trade and also training terrorists that were connected to 9/11. Yeah, okay.
Of course, the KLA was really, I think it was in relation to the KLA that I contacted you initially, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. that we established an exchange. But the thing is that I recall that when the war in Yugoslavia broke out in 99, mm-hmm. People on the left, including self-proclaimed neo-Marxists and socialists and so on, would say, yes, we support the KLA because it's a liberation movement, etc. And they would even go to the extent, and I'm talking about ZNet, they would even go to the extent of saying that it doesn't matter whether they're involved in the drug trade because that provides them with the cash mm-hmm. to wage.
Where have we heard that before?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Air America, Kuomintang, Civil Air Transport. I mean, you know, it's like this is so old hat for us. Michelle, we're at a place in the show where I do have a kind of ambiance and a rhythm, and I picked a song that I'm dedicating to you tonight.
Well, thank you very much.
From our band, New White Trash. It actually applies to both of us. But let me just also give the listeners a quick update on our situation at CollapseNet. We appear to be fully recovered from cyber attacks, which have been plaguing us for a couple of months, but within the last month almost took us out. We've had a lot of help, but we're depleted right now. We have not, as you can see now, the site's working beautifully, and that Wibia bar down at the bottom is really fun. I can pick out the Echelon eavesdropping stations that are checking out the website. But there are some volunteers at CollapseNet, and there are people we have paid part-time who are still going without money because our income has been just trashed. We had to spend some money on back-end stuff, too, and we lost a lot of time. And so it's really important that you support us because you need us, man. We're doing the job for you in Star Spangled Banner. So anything you send now will go directly toward paying the volunteers and who keep us running. Not just the volunteers, but, you know, the part-time the people who have depended upon the $500 a month here, the $1,000 a month there that we've been giving them and can't give them now. You can send checks by mail to CollapseNet Special Fund at 708 North Gravenstein Highway, Gravenstein Highway, Box 266, in Sebastopol, California. CollapseNet Special Fund, 708 North Gravenstein Highway, Box 266, Sebastopol, 95472. And thanks for that. Now, the song tonight is a song from New White Trash called Don't Dig Too Deep. The vocals on it are performed by the incredible Kristen Weigard, who was one of our bandmates. And this is a song that I had a lot of influence in. But as I thought, Michelle and I both on the same show, gee, I wonder if the government is trying to figure out how to blow up the radio show and take us both out. But the song it's all about what Michelle and I do and have done. And this is a man I'm proud to walk a long distance for. So here's Don't Dig Too Deep.
Don't you like it? No, you like it. That's why you're in. See you closer. No,
that was Don't Dig Too Deep from New White Trash. You can find us at newwhitetrash.com. Shout out to my bandmate Doug Lewis out there, who I hope is listening tonight with his dog Squishy. Coming back to the show now, I started off, Michelle, with my take on what I am reading as a step back from the brink of nuclear war, which would destroy the planet. What's your take on what events are now around the pressures building or the pressures for war against Iran?
Okay, well, first of all, as you mentioned at the outset, there's been an announcement to the effect that the joint U.S.-Israeli military drill has been canceled, and they quote budgetary reasons, so that what was involved was the holding of the most, the largest war games, U.S.-Israeli war games in Israeli history, and they were to test, of course, essentially their air defense system.
Right.
There was a massive deployment of military hardware, 9,000 troops dispatched to Israel, U.S. troops. I should say another 15,000 were dispatched to Kuwait. And in effect, really, what's happening is a lot of the troops which were previously in Iraq are being redeployed.
Yes.
And targeted towards, and they're under a different command structure, and they're there for war against Iran project. Now, you have to read this dispatch on the canceling of the drills very carefully, because in effect, what they say, they don't really, I think the budgetary limitations is an absolute smokescreen.
Yes.
They're saying essentially that their other priorities, and that the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, who is expected to travel to Israel this week, is setting up so-called contingency plans, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And those contingency plans are there to, quote, safeguard U.S. military bases in the Persian Gulf in the event of a military confrontation. So they're no longer in the war exercise mode.
Right.
Those war games, in fact, which are not being held, are really going live up to a point, because there's a big game right at the entry of the Strait of Hormuz.
Mm-hmm.
And there you have, now you've got four strike groups, okay?
Is it four? I heard it was three.
Yeah, well, you have to count the French, right?
Oh, okay.
There are two which are already there, okay? It's the Stennis and the Abraham Lincoln,
mm-hmm.
Okay? They're there.
Or was it the Eisenhower?
No, it's the Carl Vinson and the Stennis are in the Arabian Sea at this moment. And then there's a third aircraft carrier, the USS Abraham Lincoln, which is heading towards the Arabian Sea or the Gulf of Oman. And then there's Britain's Royal Navy, which has dispatched its new destroyer, HMS Daring.
Mm-hmm.
A funny name.
We had that.
Yeah. That's not an aircraft carrier, but it's a pretty important ship.
Britain has mothballed their only aircraft carrier. Otherwise, it'd be there, I'm sure.
Right. And then France has sent its Charles de Gaulle aircraft carrier, which is, it may not be as fancy as the U.S. aircraft carriers, but nonetheless, it's there, and there's a French military presence. So you've got French, British, American, and, of course, Israelis are probably all over the place. And then you have 14,000, what, no, I'm sorry, yeah, it's 14,000 troops, 15,000 troops, which are dispatched to Kuwait. Bear in mind all the weapons shipments that have been made in the last year and a half to Saudi Arabia and the Gulf States, with a $60 billion plus contract which Saudi Arabia signed. to receive, F-15s, Apache helicopters, missiles, Patriot missiles,
Christmas.
A whole load of military hardware, and I mean, this is not really, this military hardware doesn't really belong to the Saudis. The Saudis paid for it, okay, with the money from the oil economy.
Mm-hmm.
But in effect, this military hardware is deployed under an integrated command structure in the Persian Gulf, and it's to be used in liaison with the deployment of U.S. military operations.
I'm also sure that's so that the U.S. can keep control of it in the event that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia goes unstable, which it looks like it's lining up to do. We're coming up on a station break right now, Michelle.
Yeah, that's a very important point you make.
Yeah, okay, we can pick up with that after we come back. We're having a great show tonight with Professor Michelle Chosadovsky, my good friend and colleague, a brilliant guy who gets it right as much as I do, if not more. We're not keeping track, but he's been out here a long time. And it's really great to hear all the wonderful news from Gary about the way our numbers are increasing, the way our audience is increasing, the way we're reaching people. PRN is a network in the right place, doing the right thing with the right people. And I'm really grateful to this network for giving us this show. You can find us at prn.fm, and we'll be back right after these messages. Back to the Lifeboat Hour. I'm Michael Rupert. Our guest tonight is Michelle Chosadovsky. The song we faded back in with is an incredible song by Diane Patterson called High Sierra Morning. We're going to play that in full again next week. I'm really kind of hooked on that song. If you want to send questions, we already have several for Michelle, and boy, he is the answer man. You can call at 1-888-874-4888. 888-874-4888, or you can email me directly at lifeboathour@collapsenet.com. Right before we went to break, we were talking about Saudi Arabia, which is showing signs of instability, and Michelle, you were kind of lit up. Take us where you want to go.
Well, absolutely, because Saudi Arabia is tied into the United States with bilateral military cooperation agreements, the what they call interoperability, mm-hmm. the fact that the equipment that they've bought, the billions of dollars of equipment really, is under the supervision of the United States, so that it's there. They may even be U.S. pilots, so that really this is really an extension of the U.S. defense budget paid by Saudi Arabia instead of paid by U.S. taxpayers, and there you have this equipment that you can use. It's kind of on lease, but it means that the countries are dragged into a war which in fact they don't want, and they're pretty reluctant. Mm-hmm. Among these princely elites and royal families and so on, they're all related, including the Bin Laden family and the works, of
course. Well, we did some work on that, didn't we? Jeez,
yeah.
Did we work on the Bin Laden family.
And, so they're very reluctant to getting into that war, and they realize that they're being used, and they know that they will be the first victims of that war because,
yes.
Of course, the Persian Gulf is a bit like the St. Lawrence Valley. No, it's a bit larger than that.
Yes.
But it's a very narrow waterway, particularly the Strait of Hormuz.
Well, there's a very interesting calculus with respect to Saudi Arabia in that, being a Sunni country, we see Iran exerting covert pressures in support of Saudi's Shia minority, which is in the east where the oil is in Saudi Arabia. But we also see, what would you call it, a budding sectarian civil war in Iraq. And the way this lines up in the calculus is that if Israel and the U.S. do attack Iran, Saudi Arabia would find itself on the same side as Israel. I mean, it's really confused.
But that is what has been engineered, because in effect, Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states and the frontline Arab states are members. They're members of a NATO-sponsored initiative, which mm-hmm. is called the Mediterranean Dialogue, and Israel is also part of that collective. So that Israel is a de facto member of NATO. They signed an agreement in 2005 with NATO, so that in effect they've sucked all these countries in. But I think that even the governments are very reluctant, because they realize
yes.
that Dubai will be the first target. Now, you know, Dubai has a real estate problem at the moment. The prices are tumbling. Well,
market to market, bombing.
Yes. But, you know, to get back to the deployment of military hardware, we're talking about 4 aircraft carriers mm-hmm. and at least 3 strike groups, okay?
Okay.
So there's the Carl Vinson, the John Stennis, the Abraham Lincoln. They have strike groups with them. Now, the French, Charles de Gaulle, I don't know whether it has a strike group or not, but we have still 4 aircraft carriers, and then we've got other ships like the British ship. This is a very large concentration of naval hardware in the... It's in the Gulf of Oman. It will never go through the Straits of Hormuz. That's very unlikely.
I said so this week on the World News Desk. That would be an act of war, total provocation.
Well, it would be. The thing is, it would be an act of war, but at the same time, it would lead into a war pretext incident. So that's not to be excluded.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is that the Gulf of Oman is really the Iranian coastline to mm-hmm. the south. It's not the most strategic part of the country by any means.
Not at all.
But that firepower is stationed there, and of course, it's aircraft carriers, they can go anywhere.
I think the bottom line for me, and I wrote this like back in 2007 when the big deployment started over piracy, which was all manufactured by the intelligence agencies, which is that if you put enough wet cats into a small bag and shake it, you know what's going to happen, and that's what we're afraid of. We have a caller, Greg from Waterloo, Canada, a fellow Canadian. Has a question for you, Michelle. Greg, are you there?
Yeah, I am. Thank you very much for taking my call. Been following both of your work for years. Mike, you led me to Michelle mm-hmm. Back in the day. One thing that strikes me by reading your website, Michelle, is that you really do focus a lot on geopolitics, and Mike, you focus a lot on peak oil, which has literally changed my life, and I could hug you, man, for doing that for me, but I'm not going to go on about that. My question basically is just, what are your general feelings on peak oil, on the theories that Mike has, well, not theories, but the facts that Mike has put forth and regarding collapse, regarding sustainability, that sort of thing? I don't really see that emphasis on your website, Michelle.
Well, I think we haven't really researched it. We've published a fair amount on peak oil. I respect the debate on peak oil. I think it's a very important debate, but I also see that there's a lot of covert it's covert action by major oil corporations to keep the figures and the information on oil reserves
opaque,
undercover. Okay.
Yeah.
Now
okay.
There's a lot of cheap oil in the Middle East, and I think peak oil is perhaps, I would view it a little bit as a longer term process. But at the moment, there's a lot of oil which is untapped, and the oil companies know where it is, and there's a lot of cheap oil. I mean, the oil in Libya is utterly cheap, and it's not. I see that as another debate in essence. And perhaps we've been more involved in the geopolitics because we're really trying to sensitize public opinion as to the dangers of a third world war. And this is a battle for oil. Now, if there were no peak oil, you wouldn't need to go after the oil, right?
That's right.
So I think there's no straightforward focus or answer to that question.
So then you and Mike would both agree that the motivation behind the U.S. trying to establish some kind of hegemony in the Middle East would be oil, and the fact that oil reserves are looking to be at peak or at least approaching that point, whether or not you agree with
way
the timing that Mike would have.
2006, yeah. Okay, go ahead. I think
the issue is the following. If you look at the distribution of oil and gas reserves in the world today, discounting Canada's tar sands, the United States has 1.8% of total oil reserves. The Western countries together has something a bit more than 4%. Saudi Arabia is 25%, Iran is 10%, Iraq is 10%. The Muslim countries together have something of the order between 63 and 69 or 70%, depending on the database, of total global oil reserves. So you take that region of, the Arabian Peninsula extending up to the Caspian Sea Basin, which is about 60% of total oil reserves in the world. You add to that Nigeria, Malaysia, Indonesia, Algeria, and Egypt, and Libya, and there you get something close to 70%.
Right.
And then you ask the question, why are they demonizing Muslims? Well, it just so happens the oil is in Muslim land.
They're sitting on it.
We have some other questions coming
up. And then throw an export land model on that, and it gets really funky. But thank you very much for taking my call, Mike.
Thanks for calling, Greg.
Okay.
We have a question that came in from my friend Robin Westenra down in New Zealand. And thanks to that Wibia map, I see that there's a lot of people watching CollapseNet down there, down under, and I'd like to say hi to all my mates in Australia and New Zealand. Robin writes a question. Here he goes. Okay. This relates to something that has been coming through in the last week. That is the Enemy Expatriation Act. So we have an RT source with that. Seeing I haven't heard anything from this on CollapseNet, perhaps you'd like to comment. There's a confusion about the NDAA in my mind in that Obama, in his statements, seemed to take the indefinite detention of Americans off the book. Are the indefinite provisions still there? I think we've answered that. Despite Obama's duplicitous comments, or could the Enemy Repatriation Act be a way to bring in the indefinite detention through the back door? In New Zealand, we are experiencing the passing of the Food Act, which is serving to bring Codex Alimentarius, pretty nasty thing, provisions in through the back door. This would destroy everything that the transition movement in New Zealand relies on, swapping of seeds and produce, availability of heritage seeds, etc. So I think his main question is, Michelle, about the Enemy Expatriation Act. And I don't see that being used against Americans because I think that applies only to people born outside the U.S. But, Michelle, you might know more.
Well, I haven't. I know that Enemy Expatriation Act is currently in the U.S. Congress, is it not?
Mm-hmm.
And the legislation is ongoing, and it's, of course, very much related to the NDAA, which was signed into law by Obama on the 31st of December, and which repeals habeas corpus and a number of other things. But I haven't really followed this in tremendous detail. What I think has to be understood is that the repeal of civil liberties in the United States of America and also in our country is something which has been ongoing for the last 10, 11, 12 years. But 9/11 was certainly a very important watershed because it ushered in the Patriot legislation, which had already been prepared well in advance of 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really, I think, the continuation.
By Joe Biden.
fun?
Joe Biden was one of the key drafters of Patriot Act. That's been
before 9/11.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So he possibly had foreknowledge of 9/11 and was able to speculate on it.
I'm sure that he did quite well with it too.
Yeah. I know that you revealed the short selling of aircraft.
Airline stocks. You and I were both out there doing some amazing work. I think your work on 9/11. Let me just talk about 9/11 work, because Michelle and I go back to the very beginning. We were on it from day one, and there's really only four, maybe five people who did almost all of the research, which now forms what the 9/11 Truth Movement use, and that's Michelle, me, a guy named Dan Hopsicker, who did amazing work on the Venice Flight Schools, Paul Thompson with his amazing timeline, and then finally Nafiz Ahmed. But Michelle was in the trenches, and you did some work on.
I must say that Nafiz Ahmed actually plagiarized a lot of your work and mine.
Yeah.
So, okay.
You said that I didn't have to, but that's, yeah.
Well,
okay.
No, I mean, I know that because he actually admitted in a letter and said, "I'm sorry, I plagiarized you."
Oops.
So his work was plagiarized. I don't mind saying it. It's a long time ago, but I think this is the first time I mention it.
There's a lot of things being settled out now. But one of the things that you did, Michelle, that was so impressive was the work on General Mahmoud Ahmad, which was just some of the most impressive investigation and reporting I've ever seen. Why don't you tell us your quick version of that for a couple minutes, and then I've got another question for you.
Well, that was, again, it was a long time ago, but we might recall that on the day after 9/11, the head of Pakistani intelligence, Mahmoud Ahmad, was in Washington, and they said he just so happened to be there. But in effect, he came to the United States, I believe it was on the 4th of September.
Yep, that's about
right. He had meetings with Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm.
He had meetings at the Senate. He met his counterparts. That was George Tenet at the time. And he also met Porter Goss and Senator Graham, who were part of the National Intelligence Committees of the Senate and the House.
Yeah, right.
Okay, and he met many other people. But what is very revealing is that Mahmoud Ahmad was identified that was in press reports. He was identified as the money man behind 9/11.
Yes.
Okay, and that he was actually funding. I'm not saying that the alleged group that was supposed to be doing it, in other words, Al Qaeda. But there's no question that as head of the ISI, he was actually supporting the Al Qaeda affiliated groups.
There was a $100,000 wire transfer in there somewhere, wasn't there?
Yeah, that was announced. A $100,000 wire transfer. The issue is that when you look back at that, some of it was disinformation, because today we know that Al Qaeda had nothing to do with it. Okay,
that's correct. Yes,
but in any event, he was part of the legend and he was part of the conspiracy. And the irony is that on the morning of September 12th, the money man behind 9/11 was invited into the office of Wolfowitz was Deputy Secretary of
Yes.
State, and then Colin Powell, and they actually had meetings in at the State Department, and they said to him, Mahmoud Ahmad, you must help us to go after the terrorists, okay? Now, that was in effect something quite incredible, because I said to myself, if this guy is supporting
he had wired $100,000 to, was it Mohammed Atta?
That's correct. He was
Muhammad Atta. I mean,
but he was also known to support Lashkar and the various terrorist organizations in Pakistan, okay, through the inter-services intelligence, and so that he was on the one hand he was supporting the terrorist organizations in liaison with the CIA. And I should mention that Graham and Porter Goss were in Pakistan in late August. Mm-hmm. They must have left 2 or 3 days before Mahmoud Ahmad arrived in the United States. So all this was very fishy, but what was the fishiest thing about it is that he would be instrumental in Pakistan's war on terrorism, when in fact he was supporting the terrorists, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this was actually then it came out, and he was in fact he was fired at one point. He was demoted.
Yes,
I think that came about a month later.
Well, you know, all of that is kind of ancient history, but the reason I bring it up is because Michelle was putting this in print and putting this out there as it was happening, to the point where we caught the CNN's and Times web, somebody else's website had transcripts sanitized, and that's the effect that writing and journalism like Michelle has done and I have done. We really do have an impact out there.
It's also, Mike, I think it's the sheer complexity of these conspiracies.
Yes.
You know, when you looked into the short selling of airline stock, and of course that was very difficult to refute because those short selling operations were there, but then there was a cover up. Of course, there were so many different aspects. Then there were the Silverstein factor with the,
yes,
and the insurance companies and the buildings coming down. But I think what appears today, let me get back to one very important thing regarding 9/11.
I want to get to a question before we run out of time, but please go ahead.
No, but it has a bearing on what's happening now with Iran.
Sure.
Because they're accusing Iran, they had this lawsuit accusing Iran of being behind the 9/11 attacks. It's
mm-hmm.
It's a trillion-dollar lawsuit.
Nobody,
okay?
believes it. Nobody in the world believes it. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, but that lawsuit is there. Now, they want to use, and incidentally, a year before that, Saudi Arabia was accused of beating Al-Qaeda, et cetera, and there's a lot more evidence to the fact that Saudi Arabia was behind Al-Qaeda than Iran is behind. And then they said, no, you cannot indict the leaders of the Saudi royal family, the heads of state, heads of government, or whatever, that foreign country. But then 1 year later, they do it, and then they start accusing Ahmadinejad of being supporting the terrorists. But then it appears that Ahmadinejad arrives at the United Nations General Assembly and says, I'm an architect, and I believe in 9/11 truth, and those buildings, they came down through controlled demolition.
Well, the whole world is calling the United States as bluff now, and quite frankly, my government is not credible, I think, to most American people now, and I think we need to start walking, talking, and acting like that. I love the way Ron Paul has been getting in the face of media that's just been doing their corrupt, slimy, slanted stuff. And we've all earned that now. But let me get to this question before we run out of time. It's a good question. This is from Justin DeArmond. Hello again, Mike and Michelle. From my family to yours, Mike, thank you for what you do. I'm very relieved that you think World War III is averted, for the moment at least. My question is, when do you think the saber clanging will resume with regards to the oil embargo? All this troop movement is not for nothing. We live next to a military base, Fort Riley, that's in Kansas. And the training exercises within the last month are off the charts. My windows will not stop rattling from the cannons, and the skies are filled with choppers on a daily basis. Still very worried. Your and Michelle's thoughts, very quickly for me, then I'll give it to you, Michelle, for the last minute. There's not going to be any oil embargo. The world has made it very clear that it will buy Iranian oil no matter what the United States says. We've documented that all week. China and Japan are not going along, and so is everybody else. So the oil embargo is dead. But
no, the oil embargo is dead, and I think there have been several other setbacks at the diplomatic level.
Mm-hmm.
But what World War III is not necessarily on hold. Well, military planning is always put things on hold. We can't make any predictions as to what would happen. What we have to warn people is that this military buildup is real. It is real. It's happening.
Mm-hmm.
I went through the U.S. press, and I noticed that there's been a big increase in the number of reservists who are being sent to the Middle East, okay,
yes.
To the Persian Gulf,
yes.
Airmen, you know, at Air Force bases. Now, that's been going on all the time. Reservists go to the Middle East, but all of a sudden, a big increase, okay? And the reports are very scanty, so you really have to interpret them. All of a sudden, 9,000 troops in Israel, 14,000 troops in Kuwait, warships all over the place. These people are, the problem is that they believe their own propaganda. And
yeah.
That is a very dangerous thing, is that they believe that Iran is a threat to to global security, and they have to take them out, and they're bad guys. Now, that kind of ideological, that kind of inquisitorial atmosphere, where it's like the Spanish Inquisition. You don't actually think; you simply obey. And in this case, it's not the Catholic Church. It's some kind of abstract dogma that the bad guys are there to attack America, and you have to defend yourself, and you have to take them out.
Well, I'm
and,
afraid we're running out of time here, Michelle. We got about another 15-20 seconds.
Yeah, well, this is it. And I think my message is, across the United States, Canada, the Western world, we really have to confront the mainstream
yes.
media for all the lies and fabrications that they're churning out, and the fact that World War III is not front page news compared to any trivial incident that you can imagine, you know, from Hollywood gossip to traffic accidents.
Okay. Michelle Tel-Sadowski, thank you so much for joining us tonight. You've been out here for a long time. We have a new article by you that will be on the World News Desk at CollapseNet either tonight or tomorrow morning. As always, keep up the good work. Keep telling the truth, because people are listening. They may not be able to see us, Michelle, but we're like the wind. They don't have to see us, but we can see the leaves move when we blow. And it's really good to share this field with you. Thank you for joining us tonight, Michelle.
It's a great privilege to be on your program, Mike, and to be back with you after so many years.
A bientôt, mon ami.
Okay, au revoir.
Au revoir.
Bye-bye.
All right, everybody. Listen, it was a great show tonight. We've got some other big ones coming up. I'm finishing up a book by Robert Neuwirth, Stealth of Nations, with some amazing economic insights. We're going to try to line him up in the next couple of weeks. To everybody out there in Occupy, we've been covering what you do. Occupy is alive and well. It's bubbling under the surface, and we're coming back in the spring. You can count on it. Thank you all for your support. We'll see you throughout this next week on CollapseNet. Thank you to PRN for putting this great show on, this great time with all the people we work with. We'll be back next week with another episode of the Lifeboat Hour. Good night.